I was told you should never start with an apology, but I have a couple of apologies to start with. Number one, I'm going to have to truncate this a bit based on my written presentation just for time. So I will sort of summarize some sections as I go. And my other apology is I hope this hasn't been over-promoted, so, because I know Dr. Housen mentioned that, and hopefully this will not be over-promoted here. So at any rate, in Genesis 16, one can read the story of Abram attempting to provide God some help in fulfilling his promises to Abram. Since Sarah's wife was barren, Abram decided that in order to have the heir that God had promised, he must do so through having sexual relations with Sarah's maidservant, Hagar. Hagar successfully bore Abraham a son, Ishmael, but this caused great strain between Sarah and Hagar. In chapter 20, after Sarah finally had her own son, Isaac, the strained relations between the women increased until Abram sent Hagar and Ishmael away. Thus began a history of strife between two ethnic groups, the descendants of Isaac and Ishmael. For a person in the post-World War II era, when considering these two groups defined primarily in religious terms, a variety of events tend to influence one's understanding. The Holocaust, the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, the Six-Day War in 1967, the Palestinian conflict today, Hamas, the terrorist attacks of 9/11, and so on. For thousands of years, the relations between these two groups, Jews and Muslims, and the relations between Christians and these two groups, has been characterized by a variety of responses. The most varied opinions and responses could perhaps be found during the Stuart era in England. How did Englishmen of the period perceive Jews and Turks? Throughout the 17th century, a variety of opinions emerged about the Jews and Turks related to a variety of issues. Some of these opinions could be described as a continuation of medieval hostility, while others proved to be quite the opposite, rooted in a new openness. Three main areas informed opinions about these groups. The first area related to commerce, particularly as it flourished during this early modern period. The second area had to do with ideas of toleration, which began to appear in the mid-century in England. The third area, eschatology, came about due to the heightened eschatological expectation of the period, particularly between 1650 and 1690. The various discussions and opinions of the period regarding these groups were not lost on the particular Baptists in London, a newly emerging religious group who were themselves often persecuted and misunderstood. Many of the particular Baptists were of the middling sort and were involved in trade and commerce. As well, some of the earliest discussions in England related to toleration occurred because of the persecution of the Baptists and their own experience of not being tolerated. Finally, the eschatological expectation of the period was clearly evident among the particular Baptists. In fact, Hansard Knowles, one of the most significant of the first generation particular Baptist leaders and their most prolific author, connected in all three of these areas. This paper will examine on a more general level the responses of Englishmen in the 17th century to the Jews and Turks, and this will be followed by an analysis of Hansard Knowles' understanding of these two groups, specifically as it related to his eschatological writings. The first section of my paper, I dealt with background, and the very first section, I looked at the medieval context just briefly, looking at the relationships between Christians, Jews, and Muslims. And then in the second part of that first section, I looked specifically at the role of Jews in England. For the most part, the relationship between Englishmen and Jews in the medieval period tended to be negative and hostile. Jews came to England initially with William I, William the Conqueror, and they had a privileged existence for a couple of generations because of their commercial activity. They were allowed to loan money, and Christians weren't, and so William allowed them to do it, and then he profited from it. And so that went on for a short time, but then as time passed under Edward I, the Englishmen became hostile toward Jewish people, and so Edward I expelled the Jews from England, and from that point on, negative stereotypes began to abound, even though Jews were no longer present. There was a small community of converted Jews that remained in London, but really no significant community continued. Then I looked at the Muslims and the English during the medieval period. The Crusades were the main context in which the English encountered Muslims. Again, the experience tended to be one that could be best described as conflict, as they went off to fight a holy war on behalf of the church. Oftentimes it was more opportunistic than it was actually holy, and so on. But central in the minds of Englishmen throughout the medieval period was this idea of conflict with Islam. And it wasn't until the rule of Elizabeth I that a new kind of worldview began to emerge in England related to Islam, a bit more of an open perspective. And she began to develop that, and we'll talk about that in a moment. The next section that I dealt with, I looked at Jews and Turks in the Stuart context, or early modern context. The first section I entitled Turkish Delight, with a question mark. During the Elizabethan period, relations between Englishmen and Muslims began to shift. Although they continued to foster some hostile interaction, they also began to develop extensive commercial, diplomatic, and social engagement with Turks and Moors. The Ottoman Empire had developed into a major player on the world scene. In the words of Nabil Matar, no other non-Christian people interacted more widely with Britons than the Muslims of the Ottoman Empire, the Eastern Mediterranean, and the North African regencies of Tunisia, Algeria, and Libya, along with Morocco. Elizabeth led the way in cooperating with the Turks of the Ottoman Empire and the Moors of Morocco. She established commercial ventures and diplomatic ties with them. By the Carolingian period, such amicable relations had begun to cool somewhat, but they had very clearly been established under Elizabeth. English accommodation of Muslims from Elizabeth through the early Stuarts, the Protectorate, and the Restoration period invariably related to trade and commerce or diplomacy. Although no record exists of particular Baptist interaction with Muslims, William Kiffin and to a lesser degree Hansard Knowles, as merchants, involved themselves in trade and may likely have had dealings with Muslim merchants or traders. As well, Knowles served as the examiner at the custom and excise in 1653 and clerk of the check in 1655. One would think that he certainly had opportunity to interact with traders from Turkey or North Africa in these offices, particularly the former one as clerk of the check. By the end of the 17th century, the Muslim Empire was England's most extensive trading partner, accounting for one quarter of England's overseas commerce. Another area in which Muslims interacted with Englishmen was in the area of warfare as soldiers, not against each other as much in this period, but many Englishmen went off to the eastern parts of the world and to North Africa to serve in Muslim armies as mercenaries because England did not have a standing army, and this was an opportunity for glory and some perhaps opportunities for some wealth and so on. And so they became soldiers in different Muslim armies. And another area of interaction related to piracy. Throughout the Jacobean and Carolingian periods, the Barbary pirates became famous among Englishmen as they routinely assailed British ships in the Mediterranean region, capturing hundreds and hundreds of Englishmen. By the period of Charles I, they had become even more bold, and they had begun to make their way around Spain and actually invade towns on the shores of the English Channel and take prisoners and so on. Under Cromwell, that would begin to decline because now England under Cromwell had a standing army and navy, and they began to regain a bit of control on those certain areas. Because of these Barbary pirates and the negative interaction, once again, negative stereotypes began to abound. And the most common place where these negative portrayals of Islamic people could be found would be in literary writings, and theological writings. And of course, the most common literary one that we can think of is Othello under Shakespeare. You have some of that. And the theological sources, of course, in the late Tudor and early Stuart age related, of course, to eschatology. Writers began to demonize the Islamic people once again, as they had in the medieval period. Millenarian writers, in particular Thomas Brightman, who was mentioned this morning, and Joseph Mead, wrote about how prior to the return of Christ, The arch enemies of God's people, for instance, it'd be the people of the Roman Church and the Turkish people, would join together against God's people, and they would be utterly defeated by the converted Jews, who at that point will have resettled Palestine. Hanser Knoll's understanding of the Islamic people would be in this context of the eschatological writings of the period. My next section, I began to look at the Jewish interaction in Stuart England. That was the Turkish interaction. A newly emerging philo-Semitism began to appear in England during this time. We're used to the phrase anti-Semitism, meaning against Jews. Philo-Semitism, of course, meaning a love of Jews. And this began to emerge in England, particularly in the area of Hebrew studies. It became a very fashionable topic to study, and of course, tied into that was the study of the Hebrew language. It became very, very desired, and they actually would hire Jewish scholars in their universities, usually converted Jews, but to teach Hebrew because no one knew the language in the early 17th century. And as a result of that, they began to embrace this idea of the lingua humana. The lingua humana meaning that Hebrew was the original language from which all other languages came. This was the language that was spoken at the Tower of Babel before language became confused. And in fact, they would even go so far as to say Hebrew was the language spoken by Adam and Eve in the garden, and God created by the Hebrew language, because it says he spoke and it was created. And so this new desire for Hebrew began to emerge. As a result of that, English grammars began to be published, Hebrew grammars in English, so the common person could have a chance to learn this divine language. This obviously merged with this new interest in eschatology. Another area where there was some interest was in the area of embracing more Jewish ideas. Sabbatarianism, Seventh-day Sabbath, began to emerge again. The most significant Seventh-day Sabbath person was a man named Trask, who was imprisoned for his beliefs. Eventually, he would recant somewhat, and he became a member of the Jesse Church, and they even say he became a Baptist. I didn't find a whole lot, but there's a link there to Sabbatarianism. And, of course, this led to a group that came to be known as Judaizers, who were seen as kind of like the Judaizers, I suppose, in Galatians, trying to add something on to what was needed. This caused a lot of concern among Christians in the 17th century. They didn't like these forays, if you would, into Jewish culture and religious beliefs and so on. Jesse himself was reputed to have been a secret Saturday Sabbatarian. Hanser Knowles, of course, was a member of the Jesse Church. He became a member in the early 1640s. Trask was gone by 1637, but there was a connection again there with the Jesse Church, and he counted Jesse as a close friend. And I'll come back to that. Thomas Tillam, another connection with Knowles, was one of these Judaizers or Sabbatarians. He basically embraced the seventh-day Sabbath, and again, I'll come back to that. This Judaism caused a mixed response among Englishmen. So that on the one hand, you had philo-Semitism emerging, but on the other hand, a kind of phobic anti-Semitism was given a new life, if you would. It all came together in the 1650s with the Whitehall Conference, which was called together by Oliver Cromwell to decide on the question of readmission of the Jews to England. A variety of issues and circumstances led to this discussion, but probably the most important circumstance which led to this was the growing millenarianism rooted in an eschatological belief that they were living in the last days and that England had a significant role to play in ushering in the millennium. Not only did the Turks play an eschatological role, but the Jews had an even more important role. A mass conversion of the Jews would take place, ushering in the return of Christ. And so this discussion about readmission was seen as playing a role in allowing this conversion to happen, because it was argued, if we will not let them live in our borders and see our example, how can we expect them to come to Christ? And of course, they argued the Roman Catholic Church has been a poor example to the Jews, but once they see Protestantism and true Christianity at play, then they will certainly convert. And so one of the main advocates of this readmission of the Jews was Henry Jesse himself, and I welcome back to that. Not only was he a participant in the conference, but he would publish a narrative of the proceedings, and one of the best publications of that at the time. It was being in the broadsides and so on as well. At this Whitehall conference, there was another group which was against the readmission, and that group was the merchants. They were against it because they believed it was going to affect commerce for them. And so they didn't want to see the readmission of the Jews. And then some of the more high-minded clergy who saw Judaizers as a problem, they were afraid that many Christians would be led astray by allowing Jews free worship in England. All right, then the last section of my paper was Jews, Turks, and Hansard Knowles. Throughout this period, Hansard Knowles lived and ministered in London. Did he have interaction with Jews and Muslims? What was his perception of them? As Dr. Housen pointed out, of his 11 treatises, 6 concentrated on eschatology. And of these 6, 5 of them discuss these groups. I did look through all of his writings. It was only in his eschatological. I thought, wouldn't it be neat to find reference in his other writings? But I didn't, so... So we are, again, going to take a little foray into his eschatological writings. But before I did that, I thought, is there any other way of sort of seeing, determining his perspective beyond these eschatological works? And so I decided I would look quickly at Knowles' relationships during this time and see if there were links that might help us out. It would seem that Knowles had no significant relationships with Muslims and Jews, with 1 or 2 possible exceptions. His involvement in trade, which I mentioned already, in the customs office, may have given him some interaction. He may have even done business with a Muslim merchant at some point. But he was not as actively involved in trade as his friend William Kiffin. He would have very likely heard the stories of danger posed by Islam. He would have read the works. There are all kinds of works being published during this period about the people being taken captive and how horrible it is and so on. And I have a hard time believing he would not have had access to at least have read some of those. As far as relationships, though, we really don't know of any relationships with Muslims. As far as Jews, Knowles was known to have had some relationships at different times with Judaizers and Jewish sympathizers. I mentioned Thomas Tillam. As a young man, he joined the Knowles Coleman Street congregation at some point in the late 1640s or early 1650s. He would drag Knowles, I guess, into some Judaizer controversy. As a youth, Tillam had been a Roman Catholic who later became an independent and then a Baptist. According to W.T. Whiteley, he speculated that Tillam might have been a Jew who converted into Catholicism, which was very fairly common for Jews that wanted to remain on good terms with Protestants and Catholics, depending. Soon after joining Knowles Church, he received a lectureship to preach at Hexham in Northumberland. And so Knowles saw this as an opportunity to plant particular Baptist congregations in the north, where General Baptists and Quakers were having fairly free rein in their activities. And so they commissioned Tillam as a messenger to go and establish a particular Baptist church in the north. Early on, his preaching was very successful. The church was gathered, but very soon he began to introduce practices contrary to those of the particular Baptists in London, in particular, worshiping on Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath. There's a variety of interaction back and forth with London, and eventually the Coleman Church releases him and withdraws official connection with him, although it's interesting, in one of the final letters of the most... direct letters, Knowles doesn't even sign that one, which is, I find, quite fascinating. So, at any rate, communication was not cut off totally between Tillam and Knowles. Tillam also became involved in several plots with Fifth Monarchists after the Restoration to overthrow the government of Charles II, and he became involved in several attempts to help Saturday Sabbatarian families emigrate to the continent during the Restoration period. Interestingly, Tillam's emigration plans, in terms of their dates in the calendar of state papers, coincided with Knowles' departure to the continent with his family once he got out of jail after the Restoration. Another Jewish connection which Knowles had was Charles Maria de Ville. De Ville was a Jew from Metz who, like Tillem, converted to Catholicism. He became a renowned Catholic scholar in France, but eventually joined the ranks of the Huguenots, which forced him to take refuge in England. One day, while reading some Baptist works in the library of the Bishop of London, a Baptist housemaid introduced him to Knowles, who played a key role in convincing him to accept believer's baptism. Now, there's not a lot of record about that particular instance, but it certainly would could be considered a connection, if you would, with Jules. I think it was, I forget which secondary source it was that reported on that. So again, another potential connection. In his own writings, Knowles made clear arguments against the seventh-day Sabbath. And even though he fervently held to his belief in the Lord's Day Sabbath, he still maintained personal and professional relationships with Seventh-day Baptists, graciously continuing fellowship with them. Henry Jesse, of course, secretly embraced a Seventh-day Baptist sometime in the 50s. Knowles had separated from Jesse's church earlier because of baptism. Eventually he would baptize Jesse, but he always remained on good terms with the Mother Church and with Jesse. Until Jesse's death in 1663, Knowles and Jesse collaborated in a variety of areas, including opportunities in ministry as well as in public life. As well, Jesse and Knowles continued to hold very similar positions with respect to doctrine. In the 1640s, Jesse became very increasingly enamored with millenarianism, and of course Knowles himself would toward the 1660s, obviously, as he began to publish about it. It's reasonable to assume from the records that we do have that perhaps two of Knowles' closest friends were Henry Jesse and William Kiffin. Both of these men were appointed advisors at the Whitehall Conference by Cromwell. Jesse, as evident from his record of the proceedings, clearly favored the readmission of the Jewish people, primarily on eschatological grounds. One could assume, however, that Kiffin was there as a representative of the merchants, and thus, most likely, did not favor the idea of readmission, though this is not clearly stated anywhere. Kiffin did not author many tracts or treatises, and most of those that he wrote addressed Baptist distinctives, such as believer's baptism. There's nothing extant in significance dealing with eschatology by Kiffin. We do know that Kiffin tended to distance himself from millenarianism, in particular the Fifth Monarchy movement, which Knowles and Jesse tended to skirt the edges of. Knowles made no mention in his writings about his opinion of the readmission of the Jews. He certainly held to a similar eschatology as Jesse, and yet he was involved with William Kiffin at this time in some merchant activities. To what measure was he influenced in his position regarding readmission of the Jews by these two friends? We really don't know. Although no hard evidence exists to allow anything more than some speculation about the roles of these relationships in shaping Knowles' beliefs and attitudes about Jews and Turks, it is certainly quite possible that they did. Knowles clearly spent much of his life in and around London during the first half of the Protectorate, and may very well have been in contact with various merchants and traders, both Englishmen and those visiting from abroad. He would have been aware of the concerns shared by many Englishmen about the threat of Islam, both on the seas and in Eastern Europe. And he most certainly must have had more than a passing knowledge concerning the readmission debates, for he had two very close friends who were very intricately involved in the proceedings. Knowles' writings. As previously stated, if I'm in class right now, this is sleepy time, and I tell my students, stand up and turn around. As previously stated, the major place where one can encounter the Turks and Jews in his writings would be his eschatological works. However, beyond those, there's one other area of what I found interesting, intriguing, outside of those works, which I just want to quickly touch on. In 1648, Knowles published his first academic work, which is a Hebrew grammar in English. He would publish several other academic works in the early 1660s, grammars of Greek and Latin, and another grammar of Hebrew, and several other academic works beyond that. All of his grammars in the 1660s were in Latin. This one in 1648 was in English. It would definitely have coincided with the rise of Philo-Semitism during the 1640s and 50s, particularly the fascination with the Hebrew language and the desire to make it available to commoners. Knowles made clear his intentions on the title page, where he wrote, quote, "Published for the benefit of some friends who, being ignorant of the Latin, are desirous to understand the Bible in the original tongue." Now, I saw that, and at first glance I thought, ah, the original tongue, lingua humana. However, I turned the page, and the next page he says he used the phrase Bible in the original tongues, and then went on to talk about wanting to publish a grammar for Greek and English at a later date. So I'm not sure that he's using it in that context. However, the idea of having it available to the common person was very much part of what he was talking about in that foreword. As I already mentioned, his treatment of Jews and Turks can be found primarily in five of his eschatological works, none of which were published in the 1650s during the readmission debates. The earliest work, Apocalyptical Mysteries, published in 1667, examined the topics of the two witnesses, the seven vials, and the coming kingdom of Christ. Book one emphasizes the killing and resurrection of the witnesses, and I thank you for giving us a nice overview so I don't have to explain all that. That was very good. The resurrection being the renewal of their courage and zeal, the saints' courage and zeal in order to preach the word. This zeal will lead them, according to Knowles, through a period of tribulation, during which time there will be many that abandon the faith, however, and that will result in an apostasy. But this will be followed by a very, quote, very glorious reformation. Where did page 8 go? Very glorious reformation, which will enhance the, quote, cloud of witnesses. And that's a phrase that occurs several times in relation to the conversion of the Jews as well. This cloud of witnesses includes the coming in of Jews in Knowles' Apocalyptical Mysteries. This topic of the Jews receives more treatment in Book 2 of Apocalyptical Mysteries. The first section of Book 2 deals with false churches and ministers, national churches, and the Church of Rome, collecting them all together as the false church. Excuse me. Knowles then discussed the Antichrist and the persecution of the saints by the Antichrist. A section addressing the fall of Rome leads into Knowles' treatment of the fifth vial, which deals specifically with the Jews and Turks. The fifth vial will be poured out on the Euphrates River, which symbolizes the power, and this is his way of discussing it, the power and wealth of Rome. Quote, "The great Turk and his numerous mighty people, who will be at this juncture of time aiding and assisting the beast and mystical Babylon against Christ and his Zion." He saw them as working together. Thus, the fifth vial of wrath is going to be against, quote, "both Turk and Pope." However, before God's wrath can be exercised against these parties, there will be a period of, quote, "the Turks breaking in and overrunning the nations." This will be, quote, "as a plague following Antichrist upon the Christian world." So for Knowles, the drying up of the river, quote, "signifieth the wasting and destroying of the Turks' dominion, power, and people as a plague upon them for standing in the way of the Lord and his people." This will prepare the way for, quote, "the kings of the East," which he used to refer to the Jews, and the preparation, the kings of the East. The preparation that Knowles referred to here was twofold, their conversion and their return to their own land by taking a stumbling block out of their way. And he uses that word stumbling block here in this context to the Turks. He also uses it in other places to refer to the Jews, to the Roman Catholic Church. The remainder of the treatise expands on this theme, highlighting the Battle of Armageddon, where the Jews would be victorious over the Turkish armies and Christ would be victorious over Satan. Book 3 goes on to examine the coming kingdom of Christ, a kingdom of combined converted Jews and Gentiles. Knowles' eschatological writings gave evidence of his continued hope for a fuller reformation of the Church of England. Certainly his vision of the millennium as an era when the saints would rule with Christ in preparation for the end of history coincided with the thought of many Puritans of his day. He believed the victory would come through the mass conversion of people to God's truth, including a mass conversion of the Jews and the return to Palestine. This conversion would coincide with the return of Christ and the destruction of the Turks and Rome. His next two apocalyptical works contained minimal mention of the Jews and no mention of the Turks. However, they do flesh out his eschatology further. Knowles' work, The Parable of the Kingdom of Heaven Expounded, published in 1674, focuses on Christ's parable of the virgins in Matthew 25, 1-13. His exposition of the 11th chapter of Revelation in 1679 sought to, quote, explain those things therein revealed which are not fulfilled but must shortly come to pass, looking at the visions of the seven candlesticks, the seven trumpets, the seven vials. In both of these works, again, Knowles emphasized the conversion, restoration of the Jews and their joining the, quote, cloud of testimony. Each of Knowles' final works might have been what he considered his magnum opus. The World That Now Is and The World That Is to Come deals with, in two books, the first one dealing with church polity and church life in the present, and second dealing with eschatology. It was published in 1681 and at the time represented his largest work. In book two, he reiterated his understanding that the mass conversion of the Jews and the reuniting of the 12 tribes of Israel would usher in the second coming of Christ. And that was another discussion that had lots of talk and so on in the 17th century. This idea of the reuniting and finding of the 12 lost tribes, and I didn't get into this in this presentation, but Manasseh, who is the Jew from Amsterdam, who is also actively involved in the readmission situation, had published a book earlier emphasizing that these 12 lost tribes were actually somewhere in the New World, which is fascinating, but I don't have time for it. Where was I? Okay. The second coming would restore unity to the people of God, bringing together the totality of God's elect, Jews and Gentiles. And there's a reference in brackets to Romans 11 in that particular passage. In his final work, An Exposition of the Whole Book of Revelation, Knowles provided a commentary on the entire book of Revelation, written in 1688 on the eve of his own passing. At 244 pages, it represented his final work concerning eschatology. Periodically, Knowles applied the text to contemporary circumstances, and, as in his other eschatological writings, paid particular attention to the Roman Catholic Church, the papacy, the Jews, and the Turks. An exposition of the whole book of Revelation gives Knowles' most thorough discussion of the Turks, their rise, their power, and their demise. Knowles clearly believed that his last days were indeed the last days of history, and the return of Christ was imminent. Indeed, this commentary represented much more than an academic or theological exercise. The words on these pages contained an air of urgency. Certainly, as the events continued to unfold in England throughout the remainder of 1688 and into the early years of 1689, Knowles must have continued to interpret the circumstances about him in increasingly apocalyptic ways. These final two works flesh out his earlier reflections, the former in very practical terms, the world that now is and is to come, and the latter in very careful detail. According to Knowles, in nearly all of his eschatological works, one sign of Christ's return would be the proclamation of preaching of the gospel represented in Revelation as the testimony of the two witnesses. Prior to the coming of Christ, there would be an open proclamation of that coming, an announcement of the gospel of the kingdom throughout the world. This would be accompanied by an anointing of the Spirit poured out on them, and the finishing testimony would represent the culmination of the work and words of Christ's saints, and would consist of a proclamation of the kingdom of Christ, and, quote, the Lord Jesus Christ is King of nations, King of kings, and all the kingdoms of this world shall be the kingdom of Christ. This kingdom of Christ that he wrote about would become, quote, enlarged through a massive spiritual regeneration of the people of earth, a gathering of the elect, both Jew and Gentile. This gathering coincided with the destruction of the enemies of Christ and his people, the Turks and the Church of Rome. This gathering would include a mass conversion of Jewish people in fulfillment of biblical prophecy. Judah and Israel would be reunited into one nation, and the Jewish people would return spiritually to God and physically to their land. Following this Jewish renewal, quote, then shall also the fullness of Gentiles be converted. Which is interesting. He has the Jewish fullness coming and the fullness of Gentiles, as in Romans 11 again. Jew and Gentile together would worship Christ as a fulfillment of God's elect. In his eschatological works, Knowles held the doctrine of election to be the unifying factor of history, that which tied the beginning to the end of human history. The election of the saints clearly related to their perseverance. Not only did Knowles consider election in relation to the creation of the world, but also in relation to the process of being sealed and marked in the book of Revelation. The sealed ones for Knowles are the 144,000 mentioned in the book of Revelation, the fullness of, quote, Christ's redeemed ones, both from among the Jews and the Gentiles. Conclusion. Many Englishmen in the 17th century had begun to experience Muslims and Jews in various different contexts. Muslim merchants and corsairs had begun to impact the English in both positive and negative ways. As well, the readmission discussion had sparked renewed interest in the Jews, moved along primarily by eschatological ideas, with many believing the English had an especially influential role to play in helping move God's plan for the Jews and humanity toward culmination. One of the interesting things that I did encounter in the process was toleration, even though it was emerging during this period, really didn't play a lot of a role in the understanding of Knowles and the Baptists at this point with respect to the Jews and Turks. It would later with John Locke at the end of the century. Knowles' understanding and view of the Turks and Jews could well have been formed and tempered to a degree by contemporary biases and events. Certainly the people with whom he interacted may also have had an influence. However, his eschatological worldview seems to have been the primary contributing factor. Regardless of whatever kinds of contacts he may have had with Muslims during the days as a merchant or a clerk in the customs office, clearly by the 1660s, when he began to publish his eschatological treatises, he did not hold an optimistic view of them and their role in God's plan for humanity. He believed that the Muslim empires and the Roman Catholic Church and all the national churches were under the power of Satan, the enemies of Christ and his people. Eventually, they would be overthrown and destroyed. The Jews, on the other hand, held a favored place in God's plan. They would experience a mass conversion prior to the return of Christ, the tribes of Israel would be reunited and settled in Palestine, and would play a role in the overthrow of the Turks, leading to the culmination of world history in God's plan for his people.